The OKW overlooked the Volkssturm, and Volkssturm men did not particularly fear the prospect of capture by the Western Allies, save by potentially vengeful French troops. Volkssturm units in the West, then, often performed poorly or disintegrated entirely, and sometimes army units dissolved Volkssturm units themselves, palming off the better personnel to replace their own losses before sending the rest home. With the Allies in both East and West now firmly on the soil of Germany proper, the OKH in the East and the OKW in the West issued ever more fervent pleas to the troops. On 21 March, the OKH issued a directive for commanders of grenadier regiments on the Eastern Front, stressing that the life, service, and struggle of the troops must be suffused with the spirit of the movement. Rundstedt's National Socialist Leadership Section proclaimed, "The harder the crisis, the stronger the conviction as to the justice of the cause. This view must be rammed into every soldier." Army and corps-level commands issued similar pleas. Among the most rabid was 19th Army Command's call for all its officers, not just its NSFOs, to ensure that the wish of every German soldier to avenge the Jewish-led enemy's conduct of the war be intensified into fanaticism and hate. But given that the Reich and the German army were both in terminal decline, how receptive the troops were to such entreaties was another question. Propaganda continued to have an effect in the East, for it could still exploit soldiers' fear of what might happen if the Red Army overcame them. A soldier in Berlin in April 1945 gave vent to such fear in an outburst to loudly despairing civilian passengers on a train. "Silence! I've got something to tell you. Even if you don't want to listen to me, stop whinging. We have to win this war. We must not lose our courage. If others win the war, and they do to us only a fraction of what we have done in the occupied territories, there won't be a single German left in a few weeks." Even in the West, the 19th Army plastered its trucks with posters carrying slogans like, "Victory or Siberia," and "We are fighting for the lives of our wives and children." Conscious that the prospect of capture by the Western Allies held relatively few terrors for their troops, both regime and Wehrmacht sought increasingly to demonize the British and Americans, as well as the Soviets. In April, the 714th Light Division's NSFO issued a pamphlet entitled, "Gentlemen? No, Thugs." It highlighted the plunder and rape of colonial peoples in British history, the British naval blockade of Germany during the First World War, and the fact that the British had been first to bomb civilians in the current war. "Any rumors circulating that the English are decent should be countered sharply," it proclaimed. "The misdeeds of the English must be constantly highlighted." But even the annihilation by firebombing of Dresden, in which tens of thousands of civilians perished, was not enough to arrest the rising trend of surrender among German troops. British Lieutenant Peter White described the moment of surrender for one German soldier. He called out a jumbled stream of broken English in a frightened voice, "Don't shoot, please, sir! Hitler no good! Don't shoot! Kamerad, please!" At the same time, he reached suddenly into his clothing, which nearly caused me to fire, as I half expected a pistol or grenade to be pulled out. Instead, he swung what turned out to be a gold pocket watch on a chain in my face as a peace offering. Further, the troops' faith in Hitler was plummeting, at least in the West. More perceptive officers like Hans von Luck, who knew full well in what direction events were so rapidly heading, sarcastically referred to Hitler in private as "Gröfatz, größter Feldherr aller Zeiten," that is, the greatest general of all time. At the start of 1945, 60% of a sample of German POWs whom the Western Allies questioned were still professing faith in the Führer. But when the Allies interviewed a similar sample 3 months later, the figure was 20%. Just 7% believed Germany would win the war. Hornisse II was a branch of the Reich Main Security Office of the SS and Police, which had assumed responsibility for military counter-espionage since the failure of the bomb plot. On 16 February, it reported that, with the exception of new reserves and reinforcements brought up in the West, the opinion that the war is lost is widely held among rank-and-file troops. Quite apart from anything else, propaganda was also getting harder to deliver practically. The chaos on the battlefronts and in the rear made it difficult, if not impossible, for NSFOs to maintain contact with frontline units. Now, more than ever, then, the army relied upon frontline officers to motivate their troops, but the officers were too stressed and overburdened to fulfill the role properly. And even if they were not fighting the Allies day to day, the ever greater number of less experienced officers often lacked the charisma to inspire. One young officer, seeking to galvanize his men to hold out until an upturn in the strategic situation, recounted to them the parable of the two frogs struggling in a vat of milk. One frog does not struggle hard enough and drowns, but the other struggles long enough for the milk to set and therefore survives. This tale might have played wonderfully at kindergarten, but not with desperate soldiers during the war's final weeks. Just what did motivate soldiers to continue the struggle during the war's final hopeless weeks is a question made more complex by the extremely fragmentary source base. In particular, such was the chaotic state of the Army's record-keeping and of the Reich Postal Service that neither official records nor soldiers' letters have survived in the kinds of quantities that would provide particular insight. Addressing the question, therefore, requires considerable educated guesswork. For many soldiers, on the Eastern Front in particular, comradely bonds and the need for mutual survival probably continued to motivate them far more than ideological maxims. Guy Zeyer was with the Grossdeutschland division. "We fought from simple fear," he later recalled. "We fought for ourselves, so that we shouldn't die in holes filled with mud and snow. We fought like rats." Such concerns probably also motivated soldiers more than the call to protect the Heimat, seeing as it was now increasingly clear that the Heimat could no longer be saved. Numbing force of habit may also have played a role. As Major Krenz remarked to his Canadian captors in February, the only reason German troops continued the struggle was that they knew nothing better than life at the front, and provided they got to eat and smoke, they would continue to fight. But a growing number of soldiers were choosing not to continue the struggle, and not just in the West. It is uncertain just how many soldiers deserted during 1945. Some estimates put the figure at more than 250,000 by the end of 1944, but when the Eastern Front was blown open the following month, it set in train a massive increase of perhaps double that figure by the war's end. Available figures also indicate that deserters became younger and younger as the war went on. This suggests that many were fleeing because they feared that, as largely untrained recruits, they would not last long at the front. "Life is like a child's shirt, short and shitty," was one of the jokes going the rounds among the troops in the East. Why many soldiers did continue the battle in both East and West was certainly attributable in part to the terrifying deterrent of Wehrmacht discipline. In the East, fear of the Red Army might discourage many soldiers from trying to cross the line, but German commanders were taking no chances. One of General Schörner's favorite ways of incentivizing his men to fight on was to have would-be deserters hanged from a tree, with a notice attached reading, "I'm a deserter, and I refuse to protect German women and children." Rivaling Schörner's enthusiasm for disciplinary terror was General Rendulich, who in January 1945 ordered that any man found outside his unit, unless he was wounded, was to be shot. In March, Rendulich tempered his ferocity somewhat by ordering that any soldier who found himself separated from his unit was to report to the nearest unit as soon as possible, or be likewise shot. Apparently, this worked. Within a few days of the latter order, the total number of fugitive soldiers in his army group reportedly fell from 16,000 to 400. Commanders in the West continued to recognize that the temptation to surrender to the Allies on that front was much greater. On 10 March, Field Marshal Kesselring succeeded Field Marshal von Rundstedt as Commander-in-Chief in the West, and immediately ordered the formation of Flying Courts-Martial, composed of motorized Feldgendarmerie units. Kesselring seems to have relished this part of his job. Touring the area of the 7th Army in mid-March, he complained that he had not seen a single hanged deserter. The SS and police were also actively involved in hunting down deserters. On 19 February, the senior SS and police leader Southwest conveyed orders by Himmler to shoot deserters on the spot, and he assumed the army's close cooperation in such matters. But even a traditionally conservative army officer like Lieutenant General Wilhelm Wetzel, commander of 10 Corps, was also ready to declare, on 27 March 1945, 21 soldiers whom the court-martial had sentenced to death for desertion were shot in Hamburg. Every shirker and coward will meet the same fate without mercy. It may be even more surprising to learn that General Blaskowitz, who from January commanded Army Group H in the Netherlands, decreed that soldiers found wandering far from their units would be summarily judged and shot. And now that the battle was on German soil, commanders also sought to root out deserters who had made for home. The commander of the 19th Army, General of Infantry Hans von Obstfelder, ordered civilian dwellings to be combed for shirkers on the slightest suspicion, and that in towns and villages systematic raids should be carried out from time to time. In fact, whether through conviction or more likely through fear, German civilians generally seem to have been rather good at turning in deserters. To be executed, one did not even need to be a deserter. Many soldiers travelling around in the rear were on leave or special duties, but were doomed if they could not prove it. The mobile courts-martial executed at least 3,000 soldiers, deserters or otherwise. Units down to regimental level now also had the power to order executions themselves. Officers were as vulnerable to summary execution as their men. For instance, 5 officers were executed for failing to demolish the Remagen Bridge before the Americans captured it. On the Eastern Front, one highly decorated NCO, a respected platoon commander, was shot without trial simply because he was found in the rear. He had been collecting trucks from the repair companies. Fear of execution was not the only reason why many soldiers contemplated desertion but did not go through with it. For one thing, they had good reason to fear that their families would suffer if they deserted. In addition, 2/3 of a sample of soldiers captured and questioned in the West during mid-February had concluded that desertion was not worth the risk, because they believed the war would soon be over anyway. As the end rapidly approached, Hitler ran out of straws to grasp. His sense of catastrophic nationalism was now asserting itself, and on 19 March he issued the Nero Order. This proclaimed, "Military transport, communications, industrial and supply installations, as well as material assets within Reich territory, which the enemy can render useful immediately or within the foreseeable future, are to be destroyed." Hitler made the military authorities responsible for destroying objects of military worth, including transport and communications. They were also to assist Gauleiters, regional branch Nazi Party leaders, and Reich Defense Commissars in destroying industrial and supply installations and other assets. Albert Speer, however, was far-sighted enough to grasp what all this would mean for the German people's continued existence. He had already been persuading generals such as Model, Heinrici, and Guderian to spare vital economic installations in the Ruhr, Upper Silesia, and elsewhere from the consequences of scorched earth. By the end of March, Speer had persuaded Hitler that he himself should have overall responsibility for executing destruction measures, and was thus able to ensure that something would survive. As it was, however, the Gauleiters never even began to put the Nero Order into action, because although some were initially enthusiastic, they knew that it would be impossible to implement. One reason for this was the speed with which the Allies were advancing. The Germans had burned up so many of their units in trying to halt the Allies west of the Rhine that they now had no further means even of delaying them east of the Rhine. Much of the Western Allies' progress into Germany thus resembled a large, if messy, mopping-up operation. The main source of delay for Montgomery's 21st Army Group during its drive into northwest Germany was the damage Allied bombing itself had caused to German infrastructure and urban centers. By contrast, the armed opposition the 21st Army Group faced consisted, in Montgomery's words, of blocking roads and approaches with personnel from schools, base units, pigeon lofts, and so on. The final Allied push into the Netherlands involved troops from the Canadian 1st and British 2nd Armies. Canadian 2 Corps reported ferocious resistance from Waffen-SS and paratroop units facing it, less so from German Army units. In overall charge of German forces in the Netherlands was Army Group Command Northwest, headed, remarkably, given his hand in the debacle in Belarus the previous summer, by Field Marshal Busch. On 13 April, Busch ordered his immediate subordinate, General Blaskowitz, to destroy dikes for the defense of Fortress Holland. But the Allies dissuaded Blaskowitz from carrying out the order by threatening to put him on trial for war crimes if he did. Further south in the Palatinate, during the first half of March, the emboldened Americans largely destroyed the German Seventh Army in, according to Kesselring's memoirs, a swift succession of single operations involving dexterous leadership and reckless employment of tanks in country definitely unsuitable for large-scale tank operations. During the second half of March, the Americans meted out similar treatment to the German First Army. Sensing just how weak German resistance was, Eisenhower spurred on the U.S. 1st and 3rd Armies, and Patton's 3rd was in Thuringia by 1 April. At the southernmost end of the Allied advance, the French 1st Army was in the Black Forest a week into April, forcing the already depleted German 19th Army back to a defensive line between the rivers Main and Neckar. Where individual German units still possessed ammunition, something far from guaranteed during the war's final weeks, they could still spring unpleasant surprises. Some commands continued to display some of the old flexibility and initiative. For instance, the 276th Volksgrenadier Division was effective at directing all the fire from a particular battalion onto Allied positions. In the northwest German village of Ibbenburen, a force of officer cadets, largely armed with Panzerfausts, inflicted grievous losses upon the attacking British. Indeed, the Panzerfaust was the German army's deadliest weapon during the war's final weeks. Yet the Allies were now learning how to reduce even the Panzerfaust's impact. For instance, British units often had infantry ride on tanks and sent them ahead when they encountered opposition to root out the Panzerfaust operators before they could get tanks in their sights. So desperate did some German units become that they resorted to the same guerrilla tactics that the German army had traditionally despised. On 19 April, Hitler issued an order stating, "The current situation on the Western Front is disadvantaged due to an imbalance of strength, material, ammunition. Therefore, guerrilla tactics in the rear and against enemy supply lines are to be carried out." Panzer destruction units were to roam the Allied rear on bicycles, armed with Panzerfausts with which to pick off Allied tanks. But such attacks, deadly though they could be, were pinpricks in the broader scheme of things. April 1945 also saw the Western Allies' final push in Italy. The German forces here had been bereft of supplies through the Brenner Pass since the beginning of the month, and General Alexander wanted to destroy them before they could form another defensive line north of the River Po. The land around the Po was flat, greatly easing the task of attacking the now virtually prostrate German forces from the air. General von Zenger-Etterlin himself had an extremely narrow escape on 20 April. "The enemy already had knowledge of my new headquarters. I was alone in the house when it was attacked from the air. Several bombs exploded very near it, the neighboring house burst into flames, the cattle stampeded, and my washing on the line was carried by the blast into the trees." He also described the disarray that afflicted the Germans as they sought to escape over the Po. "My HQ staff was dissolved into separate groups. At dawn on the 23rd we found the ferry at Bergantino. Of the 36 point ferries in the zone of 14th Army, four only were still serviceable. Because of the incessant fighter-bomber attacks, it was useless to cross in daylight. As the level of the water in the Po was low, many officers and men were able to swim across." A resurgent partisan movement aided the Allied advance with some well-timed insurrections in northern cities. Indeed, German units, feeling increasingly vulnerable to partisan attack, went to the desperate expedient of trying to direct the partisans' fury against the Italian fascists, in the hope that they themselves would be left alone. In Germany itself, the only engagement of any significance east of the Rhine took place in and around the Ruhr. Field Marshal Model, under orders to hinder the increasingly breakneck U.S. advance, scraped together what remained of Army Group B's armored forces to launch a counterattack at Paderborn. When it inevitably failed, Model's advancing troops found themselves encircled in the Ruhr. The U.S. First Army attacked from the southeast and the Remagen Bridgehead, while the U.S. Ninth Army attacked from the north. By 12 April, between 60% and 70% of Model's exhausted troops were without weapons. On the 17th, rather than be the second German field marshal to surrender to the Allies, Model dissolved his command, allowed his men to escape across the lines to surrender, and, for fear of being handed over to the Soviets for war crimes, shot himself. Given the civilian suffering that took place in the Ruhr pocket, Model's failure to surrender promptly and cleanly was morally inexcusable. Indeed, even a few hours before the remnants of the Ruhr pocket surrendered in Düsseldorf, 5 civilians were murdered because they tried to hinder the ongoing defense. When the Ruhr pocket finally collapsed, as many as 320,000 German soldiers, the numbers are disputed, and 30 generals surrendered to the Americans. After the Ruhr, the only respite the remaining German forces in the West gained was when the accelerating Allied advance paused to bring up supplies. While 21st Army Group pushed simultaneously against the Netherlands to its west and towards Hamburg and Kiel to its east, U.S. and French forces thrust into central and southern Germany. Among other things, Eisenhower wished to head off retreating German forces that he feared might be making for a final redoubt in the Alps. But despite concerns raised by Allied intelligence about troop movements and supply stockpiles, the redoubt was a phantom. The random troop formations milling about in the Alps by late April were only there coincidentally, and in no position to make the redoubt a reality. Eisenhower may have chosen to believe the intelligence reports as an excuse to thrust towards the south rather than towards Berlin. Driving for the German capital rather than the south would have risked heavy loss of life in the urban fighting against the city's defenders, and a damaging confrontation with the Soviets, whose agreed sphere did include Berlin after all. With the Western Allies advancing so strongly, however, Stalin was eager to settle the issue of who reached the capital first. Thus, on 16 April, the Red Army launched its final offensive of the war. Defending Berlin and its approaches were the 3rd Panzer Army, the 9th Army, and a newly cobbled-together 12th Army, all grouped under Heinrich's Army Group Vistula. The Soviet forces committed to the operation were overwhelming. They comprised 171 divisions and 21 mobile corps against 32 understrength German divisions. Soviet tanks outnumbered those of the Germans by around 10 to 1. The gun barrels of the 3rd Panzer Army's AFVs were exhausted, and the troops in general suffered chronic munition shortages. 2,000 members of the Hitler Youth were deployed with the 9th Army and a further 1,500 with the Berlin garrison. And, in a further signal that the replacement system was finished, the replacement army was forced to send its training units to the Eastern Front. Luftwaffe forces, such as they were largely grounded for want of fuel. Physical German defences on the Oder and in its rear zone were uneven, nor was there any real operational point to the German defence. Hitler's hope that holding off the Soviets would split the Allied coalition looked ever more fantastical, while General of Infantry Theodor Busse, commander of the 9th Army, made the vague if eloquent statement, "When the American and British tanks are at our backs while we have prevented the Russians getting a step further, we will have done our soldierly duty and responsibility to our people, our conscience, and history." Stalin intended the attack on Berlin to take the form of a race between Marshal Zhukov and Marshal Konev. Zhukov's main attack, which went in on 16 April, did not go entirely to plan. The massive Soviet artillery bombardment, 300 artillery pieces for every kilometer, landed mainly on the already abandoned first line of defense. It then ran into strong German defenses on the Zillow Heights. Zhukov was also slowed by the ground his own artillery had churned up, and by having to channel his trucks along the few roads in the area. But the Germans could not hold the line for long. Stalin also ordered Rokossovsky's 2nd Belarusian Front to attack the 3rd Panzer Army north of Berlin. By now the 9th Army's position was seriously weakened, and it had to withdraw its remaining forces for fear of encirclement. Zhukov broke through that same day. Konev advanced south of Berlin, attacking Army Group Center's 4th Panzer Army along the River Neisse on 15 April. The 4th Panzer Army's defenses were weaker than the 9th Army's, but it did hold more wooded terrain. Nevertheless, it did not expect an attack on the Neisse itself, and so Konev's offensive went like clockwork. A letter from Corporal Helmut Fromm of 18 April conveyed something of the predicament of the troops facing it. "Now we're in front of Forst. The Russians have got a bridgehead across the Neisse and attacked this morning at 11. We had to pull back. I was left with a machine gun and 2 men. I'm the only one who knows how to use a Panzerfaust. Most of the others have only done office work. Ivan's guns are firing. 10 minutes ago, Bormer and Buxbraun were wounded. Bormer's very badly cut up. We carried him back on a plank, screaming. Whose turn is it next? Gunfire from the road. To our left, a Flak 88 is under fire. I'm trying to dig as deep as I can. In the sky above us, a Russian tank buster is circling. If I survive, I shall give thanks to God. The 4th Panzer Army fragmented before Konev's assault, and with it the link between Army Group Center and Vistula. On 25 April, Konev's and Zhukov's forces linked up northeast of Potsdam to encircle Berlin itself, and Army Group Center was locked out of what remained of the battle for the city. That same day, U.S. and Soviet forces met on the River Elbe in central Germany. The German army became atomized during the war's final weeks and days. The fate of the Panzer Division Clausewitz, one of several recently raised formations that had been given stirring titles in a desperate effort to boost their morale, is a prime example. Though it still possessed considerable numbers of well-trained troops during the first half of April, it lacked sufficient trucks, communications, and artillery. On 14 April, it was split into battle groups so that it could operate more flexibly. However, the advancing British then destroyed so many of its mobile units that less than a week later, it had only 12 tanks and assault guns left, which were picked off by enemy fire themselves soon after, and its remaining trucks had run out of petrol. The 10 officers and 60 men of divisional command split into small groups and tried to link up with the 12th Army east of the Elbe. The commander himself set out in a Volkswagen. When this was destroyed by Allied fire, he continued on a bicycle, then later on foot, before being captured by the Americans on 24 April. As larger formations dissolved, soldiers continued to fight on not just because of fear or their obligations to comrades, but also because of the surrounding chaos. Staying to fight at least gave them a predictable existence, while attempting to desert might not even be physically possible by this stage, so widespread were the hordes of refugees, wounded, and leaderless soldiers overwhelming roads and settlements. Such scenes reminded the garrison commander at Celle in northwest Germany of the Babylonians' expulsion of the Jews. Even if a soldier did try to desert, he might not even get so far as being picked up by a roving court-martial. For during the war's very last days, soldiers risked being killed by their own comrades if they made a break for it. On 21 April, for instance, General von Manteuffel, commander of the 3rd Panzer Army, ordered that if soldiers retreated before enemy fire or attacks without a fight, all heavy weapons, flak and artillery behind them should fire on them directly. Clusters of retreating, demoralized soldiers, separated from their units or from units that had already disintegrated, made a pitiful impression upon civilians in Franconia in northern Bavaria. An eyewitness described their degradation. Some were bandaged, some were not. Others limped as their feet had swollen. Only a few had weapons. Some came on farm wagons, a few still on military vehicles. We saw two on unsaddled ponies. My wife was shocked by the misery of these German soldiers. She cried. Another commented, "One was painfully reminded of pictures of the retreat of the Grand Army from Russia." A third described how many German soldiers who had become separated from their units begged at night for food in civilian clothing. They moved into the forest and left their uniforms and weapons lying in the woods. Other units or retreating groups of individual soldiers looked out for themselves at civilians' expense. The Psychological Warfare Division of the U.S. Army commented, "The Wehrmacht is an army in disintegration and in retreat, and its soldiers are going through a nasty phase of demoralization. This has strongly increased the inclination of these uniformed men to mistreat the unfortunate civilian population. Army units would sometimes forcibly requisition supplies from the population in order to replenish their own, and such actions could easily escalate into wild plunder. I'm 70 kilometers, 44 miles away from Berlin in the small village of Genschmar," wrote Lance Corporal Ludwig B. of the 25th Panzer Grenadier Division. "It saddens my heart when one sees how well established these people are and yet how the Lanzers treat their property. In Breslau, according to one eyewitness, some enterprising lads wrapped in fur hats, with a procession of Polish female cooks and plundered cattle in their wake, came across to us like Landsknechts from the 30 Years' War. They noisily swanked around and lashed out along the main street. They butchered and cooked for their own people and plundered alcohol from the nearby villages. Having witnessed or indeed participated in so much killing and destruction, many soldiers probably felt too hardened to care if civilians on their own side suffered too. Army units that were still in the fight could inflict even worse suffering upon the population. In the West, the OKW ordered on 12 April that all towns be defended to the last, and that anyone hindering the commandant in his duty would be sentenced to death. When the fighting reached a particular town or village, what happened next often depended upon how fanatical its commandant was. The commandant of Bonn, for instance, abandoned the town rather than see it destroyed. He was fortunate just to lose his rank and receive a sentence of 5 years' imprisonment. But if a Wehrmacht or Waffen-SS unit did decide to hold a village against the Allied advance, that effectively guaranteed its obliteration. Post-war Allied reports recount numerous cases of German soldiers and civilians coming to blows when a unit attempted this. In line with a directive Himmler issued at the end of March, some commanders ordered their troops to execute civilians who tried to prevent them from carrying out defensive measures, or who showed the enemy the white flag. On 17 April, for instance, General of Infantry Friedrich Schulz, commander of Army Group G, ordered that where civilians did show the white flag, the relevant houses are to be destroyed, burned down, and male inhabitants of those houses aged 16 and over are to be shot. Army troops followed such orders on countless occasions during the war's final weeks. Another symptom of the army's dissolution, though one for which the inhabitants of many a German village were doubtless grateful, was that many units were running out of the weapons and ammunition they needed to make a fight of it. On 15 March, for instance, the 353rd Infantry Division reported that one of its companies comprised 86 men armed with 62 German, Greek, Belgian, and Polish rifles, 12 machine guns, 9 of which were Danish, and 1 rapid-fire gun, 1 assault gun, 1 machine pistol, and 2 pistols, 2 medium-sized grenade launchers, and 35 anti-tank guns. Motley as this array of weaponry was, it was above average by this stage in the war. The problem was that the men only had about 10 rounds per weapon. As for manpower, events in the town of Krefeld in western Germany showed what happened when the Germans tried to hold out with the various scrapings they had thrown together. The town commandant assembled 2 police battalions who fled in panic at the first Allied attack, and 150 Hitler Youth boys, more than half of whom were killed. The army could be blamed directly for tragic farces such as this, because it often planned its defense with divisions that had already been gutted or destroyed. It retained such divisions in its order of battle, even if their remaining manpower had been transferred elsewhere, because their divisional staffs still existed. Another well-worn image from the final phase of the German army's disintegration is of commanders spending their time putting pins in maps for the sake of something to do. This was a prominent way in which officers tried to keep sane as the end approached. Lieutenant Colonel Ulrich de Maizière, de facto chief of operations at the OKH for 2 weeks during April, hung a sign on the back of his office door, quoting a line from a film which generated considerable gallows humor among his colleagues. "It is not my place to think about the senselessness of the tasks that are assigned to me." Displacement activity sometimes took on surreal forms, with high command discussing such weighty matters as proposed style changes to the Panzer uniforms, prize givings for the best pack animal equipment, and a proposed Easter service in the garrison church at Potsdam. Some senior officers, bizarre though it may seem, stayed focused on professional matters for career reasons. General Guderian was effectively sent on gardening leave on 28 March, following a failed and costly attempt to relieve the town of Küstrin, approximately 80 kilometers, 50 miles east of Berlin. Guderian's successor as OKH Chief of Staff was the delusional General Hans Krebs. Krebs, Field Marshal Model's one-time Chief of Staff in the Ninth Army, was later described by one officer as a Rasputin-like type who would have loved to heal mankind from all its woes, but with means which made fools of everyone, including himself. Krebs now chose to ignore the fact that the army was collapsing all around him. Instead, he delighted at the opportunity to follow in the footsteps of such illustrious predecessors as Moltke the Elder, the military victor of Germany's wars of unification, and Schlieffen, whose strategic vision had dominated German war planning during the years up to 1914. The careerist sense motivating some other generals was more calculating. Maintaining a professional performance now might win them favor with the Western Allies after the war. At the other extreme, 67 generals and admirals, Krebs among them, when he finally concluded that his world had ended, eventually committed suicide rather than endure post-war existence. Some railed against the traitors of July 1944, whose treachery had supposedly rotted the system before it had been exposed, and directed all the blame for Germany's imminent defeat towards them. Others still took any combination of drink, drugs, and general self-pity. Such was the case, according to Hans von Luck, with the final commander of the 21st Panzer Division, Lieutenant General Werner Marx. Luck encountered him for the last time in a spectral scene on the evening of 16th April. Our divisional commander appeared on the landing of the first floor, in a nightshirt. I saw him sway slightly. The general staff officer made an unmistakable gesture. A few cognacs. It rather shook me that this highly decorated officer was no longer up to the situation psychologically. In this increasingly unhinged atmosphere, officers with clearer heads found it even more dangerous to risk doing or saying anything that might be construed as defeatist. Much had to remain unsaid, recalled the General Staff Officer Rudolf Freiherr von Gersdorf after the war, because speaking openly was dangerous. Even more to the point, it often remained essential for one's own well-being to be seen to be doing everything to inspire, or, failing that, terrorize one's men into fighting on. Thus did the process of the army's self-destruction perpetuate itself to the very end at the level of the individual. Any remaining semblance of order diminished further still when, on 22 April, the Eastern and Western Fronts and the jurisdictions of the OKH and OKW with them crashed into one another, splitting the Reich and the remaining German forces in two. Dönitz, desperately trying to get sailors off his ships and train them for land fighting within days, assumed command of remaining German forces in the north. Kesselring did the same in the south, commencing with a desperate counterattack order to two panzer divisions who were unable even to move. The collapse of communications severed contact not just between the forces defending the two halves of the Reich, but also among the forces within each half. What individual officers and men did at the precise moment when death or surrender became the only options depended upon their characters, their circumstances, and whatever freedom of action they had. The hordes of refugees and wounded often restricted their movements and thus their options. A corporal of the Kurmark Division, fighting with the Ninth Army, described a scene he witnessed in a forest at the end of April, as soldiers clambered onto a king tiger in a frantic effort to escape. We reached a clearing where one tank remained. It was already completely covered with wounded. We turned away because the scene of other soldiers fighting each other for a place was so frightful, sad, and full of suffering. Sometimes soldiers fought on to buy time in order to escape the chaos. Conversely, if circumstances allowed, they might use the same chaos to slip away and make for home. When the time finally came to surrender or die, most who still had a choice chose the former, even on the Eastern Front, if for no other reason than sheer exhaustion. Hans von Luck and his remaining comrades, for instance, surrendered themselves to fate and captivity with only seconds to spare. We found a hiding place under a thick clump of bushes. Suddenly we heard Russian sounds. To our dismay, we saw a line of Russian soldiers combing through the wood and heading straight for our hiding place. "We must get away from here," we whispered to each other. "Over there, about 80 yards away, there's thick undergrowth. We must try to run there and disappear into those bushes." The Russian skirmish line came menacingly closer. "Go," I whispered. With a bound, we ran out and reached the undergrowth. The Russians had seen us. Some fired on the move, but without hitting us. To our dismay, once again, the undergrowth was only a few yards deep. Behind it, we were suddenly confronted with a lake. The end, all over. There was no more escape. "Weapons in the lake," I shouted to the others. Surrounded by Russian soldiers with their guns at the ready and with no chance of getting away, we slowly raised our hands on that morning of 27 April 1945. But while Luk and his comrades contemplated the prospect of Soviet captivity, the last sizable battle of the war in Europe was still being fought. Militarily, the Red Army had already won the Battle of Berlin before it took the fight into the city. Dramatically, however, the battle in the city itself, which took place between 26 April and 2 May, was the climax of the war in Europe. A basic order of 9 March, issued by the Command of Defense Area Berlin, decreed that the city was to be defended to the last. One of Hitler's remaining crumbs of inspiration during this final phase of the war was the dictum of his hero Frederick the Great of Prussia, "Whoever throws his last battalion into the struggle will be the winner." The enemy was to be pulled into a network of resistance nests, strong points, and barricades, and bled white. Berlin's housing blocks, canals, railway tunnels, and anti-aircraft towers were to be fortified and incorporated into the defense. The fact that Allied bombing had reduced 70% of the city center to rubble was also something the defenders could use to their advantage. But as ever during the last days of the Reich, the reality fell far short of the rhetoric. Suitable transport and tools were in short supply, and it was impossible to assemble anything like the number of workers who would have been needed to transform Berlin into anything resembling a proper fortress. In any case, 56 Panzer Corps, in overall charge of the city's defenses, did not have the manpower to hold such a network of defense. The Soviets committed nearly 500,000 troops to the attack on Berlin itself, together with 1,500 tanks and self-propelled guns, and no fewer than 12,700 artillery pieces. Every Soviet division included assault units mixing infantry, pioneers, grenade launchers, tanks, and self-propelled guns. Against them, 56 Corps could commit 50,000 combat troops, together with 10,000 Volkssturm men and the aforementioned 1,500 Hitler Youth boys. All efforts to feed German troops into the battle from outside the city were a failure. When one such attempt, assigned to Obergruppenführer Felix Steiner, came to nothing on 22 and 23 April, the news made Hitler go into a paroxysm of rage and declare the war lost. Then, on 27 April, having temporarily regained his self-control, Hitler ordered all units between the Elbe and Oder to march to relieve the capital. They were too hard-pressed, immobile, or both, to be in a position to obey. Despite atrocious conditions and impossible odds, many German units resisted ferociously during the battle. For instance, 300 defenders held the Soviets for 8 hours in the German parliament building, the Reichstag, after Hitler had already committed suicide on 30 April. That said, so uneven was the quality of the German defenders of Berlin that the Soviets probably suffered less from their opponents' proficiency in urban warfare than from the political pressure they themselves were under to win a rapid victory. Even so, throughout the 2.5 weeks of the Battle of Berlin, the German defenders inflicted losses of 78,000 dead upon the Red Army. Hitler's appointed successor was Grand Admiral Dönitz, who now assumed the twin titles of Reich President, a title that had been dropped on Hindenburg's death, and Commander-in-Chief of the Wehrmacht. The new Commander-in-Chief of the Army was the recently promoted Field Marshal Schirner. But Hitler's death precipitated successive surrenders on all major battlefronts. Fear and desperation had ensured that the army leadership, like other Nazi elites, had continued the struggle as long as it had. But by late April 1945, with the Reich's destruction assured anyway, it was only Hitler's own person that kept the institutions of the Third Reich functioning, and the war continuing. The chiefs of the various Nazi power blocs had drawn their legitimacy from being seen to do Hitler's will. With him gone, their mutual antagonisms, the lack of any tradition of cabinet-style government, and the chaos now enveloping the Reich, all precluded any possibility that they might unify to try to continue the war without him. Similarly, the army's generals had long lacked any single collective military decision-making body like a Joint Chiefs of Staff. They now also lacked any sense of collective identity, and any real ability to prevent the piecemeal surrender of an army physically incapable of fighting on. A brief survey of this wretched fag-end period will suffice. The first capitulation came on 2 May, in Italy. Because it was far removed from the Reich, this was the only battlefront on which a German commander had dared initiate surrender negotiations while Hitler was still alive. In the northern and eastern Netherlands, German forces held out until they were assured they could surrender to regular Allied forces rather than to the Dutch population or the Dutch resistance. Indeed, given the catastrophic effect that the Hongerwinter had had upon relations between occupier and occupied, the Germans had good reason to feel frightened. Long quiescent Scandinavia saw open fighting between resistance forces and the now moribund, poorly provisioned, and increasingly undisciplined German occupation troops. Further south, such piecemeal efforts as were made to establish an Alpine redoubt floundered when the Allies swept up through the Brenner Pass following the capitulation in Italy, and in some places local civilians helped U.S. troops overcome German positions from behind. German forces in the west and the Dönitz government itself clung on a little longer in a vain effort to achieve some sort of negotiated surrender with the Western Allies, or, at the very least, to enable more German troops to surrender to them. The best Dönitz was eventually able to achieve was to order troops fighting in the east to try to break out to the west to surrender. When General Jodl signed the official capitulation at Eisenhower's headquarters at Reims on 7 May, the process of surrender was virtually at an end. Some units in East Prussia were trying to fight their way out as late as 14 May. East of Prague, the remnants of Schörner's Army Group Center tried to head west to surrender to the Americans, but failed and went into Soviet captivity. Schörner was not among them. At the last minute, he abandoned his men and escaped by aircraft to the Alps. His ostensible reason for doing so was to oversee preparations for the Alpine redoubt. Considerable mystery surrounds the exact circumstances of Schörner's flight, but a healthy cynic would surmise that Schörner had decided, in what was a far from unique course of action for German commanders by this point, to try and escape the fate that awaited his men. Most of his troops surrendered to the Red Army on 11 May. The fate of Schörner's men, not least of the 11,000 who died pointlessly during the week leading up to the 11th, exemplifies the futility of the struggle in which the German army was embroiled during the war's final weeks. One thing that could not be said of the German army in 1945 was that it capitulated in the manner of 1918. In this sense, the Nazi regime's efforts, in which Wehrmacht propaganda had been complicit, at least to prevent Germany from succumbing to a second stab in the back, had succeeded. Many senior officers seemed to have fought on as long as they did because, as they saw it, they could thus expunge the dishonor of the surrender of November 1918, and the treachery of those fellow army officers who had tried to assassinate Hitler and make peace with the Allies in July 1944. One anecdote will suffice to exemplify this mentality. In southwest Germany, as Allied forces approached from the Brenner Pass, the commander of the 47th Volksgrenadier Division vainly ordered his men to break out to the south, for no other reason other than to avoid capitulating. For this officer, then, not surrendering had become an end in itself. And during the decades immediately following the war, former commanders such as Kesselring would wax lyrical in their memoirs about how, in contrast to 1918, the German army and people had struggled heroically in 1945 against insurmountable odds. In fact, the final 10 months of struggle had achieved nothing other than mass death and destruction within Germany and its immediate neighbors. Of the Wehrmacht's 5.3 million war dead, just under half died after July 1944, and of those, 1.5 million perished after December 1944. And in resisting as long as it did, the German army, like the rest of the Wehrmacht, also enabled the Nazi regime to continue pursuing its murderous policies to the end. The first 2 months of 1945 saw the German army's remaining props kicked away. Huge losses in Poland, eastern Germany, and the areas west of the Rhine, the Red Army's capture of the Silesian industrial basin, and the ongoing devastation wrought by Allied bombing, all combined to devastate what remained of the Army's economic and manpower base. Thus perished any remaining attempt the Army might have made to stem the Allies' advance into the Reich's heartland. Only fleeting local successes remained within the German Army's power during 1945. Yet there were precious few of these, and they too diminished at a rapid rate. By the time of its final battles, the German army was no longer fighting primarily in the hope that it might ultimately avert defeat and destruction, still less out of an animated belief in Hitler or National Socialism. A number of senior officers appeared to have fought on out of some warped sense of honor, but the German army as a whole fought on as long as it did, to the point of its own self-destruction, because until the very last minute, more than enough of its officers and men believed they had no other practical choice. The army's internal discipline became too lethal and general conditions too chaotic to allow any other option but to go on fighting. Comradely bonds also compelled soldiers to fight on, though for practical as well as emotional reasons. Quite apart from anything else, sticking with one's comrades might be a better survival guarantee than getting lost in the mayhem. Hitler's own death precipitated the army's official dissolution, but it was effectively destroyed already. Conclusion. It is hard to conceive that the army that overwhelmed France and brought Europe under German domination in 1940 had been totally destroyed 5 years later. It is equally hard to conceive how an army whose leadership in 1933 supposedly cherished the values of decency, morality, order, Christianity, all values which went with a conservative idea of the state, eventually came to collude in genocide and rapine across Europe and in its own country's self-destruction. The leadership of the German army willingly entered into a Faustian bargain with Adolf Hitler that provided the opportunity and means to meet its highest aspirations. Ultimately, however, the army failed both militarily and morally. It is important to appreciate how vast, diverse, and subject to profound change the army was over the course of the war. The gamut of senior commanders included prodigious maneuver warfare practitioners like Erich von Manstein, mediocre yes-men like Ernst Busch, fanatical disciplinarians like Ferdinand Schirner, and Nazi-averse conservatives like Wilhelm Ritter von Leib. The array of values and capabilities across so vast an army was even wider among its still more numerous and diverse middle-ranking and junior officers and NCOs, as well as among its rank-and-file troops. The various challenges and circumstances that confronted them, and how they sought to surmount them, likewise further shaped their behavior in diverse ways. The size and scope of this picture must be kept in mind when considering the five main questions that have been the focus of this study. In seeking, firstly, to understand why the German army as an institution aligned itself with Nazism so willingly in the first place, it is necessary to appreciate how far the German army's growing subordination to the Nazi regime during the 1930s went hand in hand with its support for the regime's foreign policy. During the mid to late 1930s, most of the army's leadership hailed from a generation who had been staff officers during the First World War. A somewhat younger generation of Frontkämpfer was also beginning to assume leadership positions. Frontkämpfer were more enthusiastic about National Socialist ideals than their older colleagues were. The brutal, chaotic conditions of the First World War and its aftermath created the perfect environment for violent, resentful anti-Semitism and anti-Bolshevism not only to flourish, but also to feed off one another. Nazism also particularly appealed to Frontkämpfer because it was they who identified most strongly with the Nazis' military ethos, and who approved most strongly of the fact that many veterans filled both the rank and file of the Nazi movement and many of its leadership positions. The army leadership's older, most senior officers also shared some ideological beliefs with the Nazis. What motivated them most, however, was their desire to re-establish Germany's great power status and to secure a central role for the army in that process. They did not regard themselves simply as a standing army, unquestioningly supporting whichever government had been democratically elected. They saw themselves as power brokers with a responsibility to ensure effective government in the interests of the state. They did not believe the Weimar Republic could re-establish either the army's central role in German society or the army's ability to wage the kind of war that would restore Germany to national greatness. After they tried and failed to establish an authoritarian national conservative leadership in 1932, the most senior members of the army leadership stifled any reservations they held about the Nazi movement and became persuaded that the movement offered them the best remaining opportunity to achieve their goals. Few, if any, at the outset sought the kind of war Hitler envisaged, but they certainly sought German hegemony in Central Europe. Furthermore, the army leadership endeavoured to ensure that, at such time as a hegemonic war were needed, the German population would not waver in its commitment to it. National Socialism, it seemed, would ensure this also by mobilizing the mass of the people with a unifying ideology and by ruthlessly suppressing internal dissent. For the army leadership as a whole, the two most attractive elements of the package that National Socialism appeared to offer were uninhibited rearmament and a return to conscription. It was, after all, these, above all else, that spoke most loudly to the officer corps' very purpose. They would enable the officer corps to re-establish its national and international prestige through a large standing army. They would also provide an effective means of militarizing German society. More technocratic officers, of whom the select Reichswehr officer corps bequeathed a great many, were particularly attracted to the prospect of high-tech mechanized rearmament. And the army leadership as a whole recognized that such rearmament would create an army with major offensive capabilities, of the kind that could win wars quickly before the superior material resources of Germany's opponents began to tell. Important as these explanations are, they do not fully account for why the army leadership and the senior officer corps more generally increasingly subordinated themselves to the Nazi regime as fulsomely as they did. While there were many shared values and traditions among members of the officer corps, there were also divisions between more independent-minded officers, men who were not anti-Nazi but who sought to maintain the army's distinctive identity, and generally somewhat younger, ideologically enthused officers who veered more towards unconditional, heartfelt support. Many officers had no particularly strong convictions either way, but were certainly attracted to elements of Nazi ideology and prey to events that pushed them further towards full acquiescence. In order to understand why the army began to subordinate itself to the regime so thoroughly, it is important to recognize that its most important relationship lay not with the Nazi regime in general, but with Hitler himself. It may seem perplexing that such a proficient fighting force, led initially by conservative-minded generals, willingly followed a man whose worldview had been poisoned by extreme racial and ideological hatred since his early adulthood, whose own military career had never progressed beyond the rank of corporal, and whose ambitions for Germany went beyond reasserting its great power status in Europe to encompass megalomaniacal schemes of intercontinental domination. In fact, though the army leadership did not completely and fervently share the sum of Hitler's ideological and geopolitical goals, it increasingly identified with them to a great extent. Increasingly, throughout the years of the Third Reich, the army pursued Hitler's goals, subjugated itself to his will, and perpetrated crimes in his name. In particular, the army was increasingly subordinated to Hitler following his reorganization of the high command and his accumulating foreign policy successes during the mid to late 1930s. The latter made Hitler more popular with the German people, more daring in pursuit of his foreign policy goals, and less willing to tolerate cautionary advice from his generals. When Hitler's star rose even further following the Wehrmacht's string of victories during the first 2 years of the war, most generals became even less inclined to challenge him. It helped that many were bribed, particularly after the fall of France, with financial and professional rewards. Most generals also came to believe that military success compensated for their now non-existent political influence. As more independent-minded generals were sidelined or disposed of, or resigned themselves to having less influence, their place was increasingly taken by officers who were more ideological, more career-minded, more sycophantic, or any combination of these. This process silenced dissenting voices even further. Events such as the clear-out of older officers during and after the winter of 1941 to 1942, and the repercussions of the failed attempt to assassinate Hitler in 1944, further entrenched the senior officer corps' subservience to the Führer. Whether out of genuine conviction or convenient rationale, senior officers invoked their Hitler oath as a reason to eschew taking any action against the Führer or the regime, even as military disasters accumulated. They largely stood by as Hitler assumed ever greater destructive control over army operations. A vital ingredient in the further strengthening of the German army's support for Hitler during the war's early years was the energizing successes it enjoyed during its early military campaigns. Material and numerical strength and technical proficiency were, of course, vital to the German army's successes, and particularly crucial during its campaigns in Poland in 1939 and Southeast Europe in 1941. Yet the army's other early triumphs in Scandinavia and the West during 1940, and in the early stages of its attack on the Soviet Union during 1941, were less